top stories, a working group of experts meets to discuss sanctions removal on the second day of talks between Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories in Vienna. The chief of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says the organization is facing a severe funding crisis. Also in the headlines, Dutch officials say the new COVID-19 variant Omicron was present in the Netherlands before its detection in South Africa. A new round of talks in Vienna between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal has continued for a second day. Tehran says it will settle for nothing less than the removal of sanctions against the country. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says Tehran will also give no commitments beyond the provisions in the 2015 deal. Said Khatibzadeh stressed that issues such as step-by-step negotiations or new commitments have no place in the negotiations. He said the Iranian government has joined the talks with a fully prepared delegation and serious resolve to ensure that the sanctions are removed. Khatibzadeh noted that the talks will move on the right track if the opposite side takes part with good intentions and avoids wasting time or making childish excuses. Iran and the P4+1 began talks on Monday after nearly a six-month hiatus. Omar Lesgi is our correspondent at the venue of the talks in Vienna. She says a working group of experts has met to discuss sanctions removal, which has been acknowledged as the top priority of the negotiations.
Today, we're having the working group on sanctions removal, which has been acknowledged as being the first priority in these talks, continuing its work at the expert level. But of course, there's a lot of diplomacy taking place at the level of political directors as well. We know that just a few hours ago, the Russian ambassador and the lead delegate here in these talks tweeted saying that the U.S. has confirmed its readiness to lift all sanctions that it deems are inconsistent with the JCPOA in return for Iran going back to full compliance. But he said, and I'm quoting him, the devil is in the details, and the concrete list of sanctions to be lifted is still subject to negotiation. We've talked about this, of course, before. Iran says that it wants all of the sanctions to be removed. This includes those imposed additionally under the Trump administration and some of them under other labels. And the U.S. negotiating team does not consider JCPOA related, but Iran has said that it wants all of these sanctions to be removed because Iran says if the other side is asking the Islamic Republic to go back to the 2015 deal, then they also have to go back to that to the situation where none of these sanctions existed and none of this maximum pressure campaign had been launched against the country.
Political commentator David Yagubian says Iran's stance in the Vienna talks is fully consistent with international law.
I would not consider Iran's line to be tough. I would consider it to be consistent with international law, consistent with United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231, and fully consistent with the JCPOA, even after 2019, when under Articles 26 and 36 of the agreement, Iran began to curtail some of its commitments because of the U.S. withdrawal from the agreement in May of 2018. So Iran hasn't been tough, in my view. It has been consistent, and it has stuck to the parameters of the agreement and to international law. The fact that the Iranian negotiating team is not willing to humor any extension, any additions or changes to the agreement is, in my view, consistency rather than a tough line. What Iran got out of the JCPOA, at least ostensibly, was sanctions relief. And I say ostensibly because the Obama administration, which signed the deal, didn't even provide full sanctions relief. But Iran is in this agreement to obtain sanctions relief. If sanctions relief, verifiable sanctions relief, cannot be provided by the United States as a signatory of the agreement, Iran is simply being consistent with the agreement and with international law by refusing to humor such changes or toying with this piece of nonproliferation architecture.
The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees is facing a severe funding crisis. UNRWA Chief Filippo Lazzarini says the organization has failed to pay the salaries of thousands of its employees for November. He says the agency has less than half of the money it requires to continue its operations in the next 2 years. According to Lazzarini, funding for UNRWA has stagnated since 2013, while the needs of refugees keep increasing. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency is crucial for millions of Palestinian refugees. It runs schools, clinics, and food distribution programs, among other activities. The Israeli foreign minister tells French President Emmanuel Macron that anti-Iran sanctions must remain in place. Yair Lapid says the bans must instead be toughened and military threats must be applied against Tehran. He made the pleas during the last leg of his three-day trip to the United Kingdom and France. On Monday, Lapid met with British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss in London. The two vowed to prevent Iran from becoming what they called a nuclear power. Iran's foreign ministry denounced the remarks as a sign that Europe wants the Vienna talks to drag on and that it does not seek the effective implementation of the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran has time and again said its nuclear program is solely for peaceful purposes. A report says the new COVID-19 variant might have already existed in Europe before its discovery, but by South African scientists. The Netherlands says it has gathered samples that show Omicron traces a week before it was detected in South Africa. The new findings have raised questions about the origination of the variant and the necessity of the travel bans against South Africa. Several countries in Europe have reported cases of the Omicron variant and imposed travel restrictions against South Africa. Earlier, Brazil also reported infection with the new strain in two people, noting that one of them had not left the country.
As more cases of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 are detected in Europe, questions mount over its true origin, how contagious it is, and of course the health threat. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Tuesday.
The thing that's really on everybody's mind is the new variant.
The head of the European Medicines Agency, Eimear Cook, told lawmakers that greater efforts are needed to get more people vaccinated in the EU.
Especially in those member states where the rates are dangerously low. And this is particularly important as we learn more about Omicron.
Even though we know little about the new variant, EU countries are increasing restrictions. Most legislators agree that vaccination rollout remains key.
We were all a bit late in preparing the booster, and it is the biggest problem is, of course, that people don't get the first and second dose.
Citizens have been reacting to the latest developments.
With this new variant, well, I don't know. I mean, the economy is not actually quite strong, I would say, so whether we really balance, like, health, you know, and survival.
From the stock exchange's reaction, it may have a negative impact on our lives again in terms of economy.
One quarter of adults in the EU have still not been jabbed. A contributing factor to hesitancy, it has been suggested, is the refusal of pharmaceutical giants to release vaccine clinical trial data.
This is not just an issue of taxpayers' fund, but also an issue of trust. Trust in the European institution can be built by transparency.
Many EU legislators are saying it's imperative that Omicron serves as a warning. They are again repeating a message they've been trying to send to political leaders now for almost a year. The West must stop hoarding vaccines from poorer nations, otherwise more variants and perhaps more deadly variants will be coming. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Moving on, rocky relations between Washington and Beijing sink to a new low as the Pentagon says it will reinforce deployments and bases in the Indo-Pacific region to, quote, better prepare the U.S. military to counter China. Beijing has slammed the plan, accusing Washington of using the China threat theory to serve its hegemonic goals.
Tensions are running high between the United States and China as Washington ramps up pressure against Beijing. the Pentagon says it is planning to improve bases in Guam and Australia to counter what it calls the threat from China. The projects come as part of the U.S. military's global poster review, which calls for prioritizing military construction across the Pacific Islands and additionally military cooperation with allies and partners in the region. Beijing has slammed the plan, accusing the U.S. of creating an imaginary enemy and sparing no efforts to encircle and contain China. It says Washington is using the China threat theory to expand its military presence in the region and serve its hegemonic interests. Since coming to power, President Biden has made China his main foreign policy agenda, with a focus on the Indo-Pacific region. Taiwan has been a major thorn in the deteriorating relations, as Washington has been trying to appease Taipei by arming it. That's despite repeated warnings from Beijing, which views the self-ruled island as part of its territory under the One China principle. The Sino-American standoff is not limited to Taiwan. The two have been at odds over a host of other issues. Beijing has repeatedly accused Washington of interfering in its internal affairs by fueling unrest in the semi-autonomous Chinese city of Hong Kong. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. China and the U.S. are also engaged in a trade war, with both seen imposing tit-for-tat tariffs during the previous U.S. administration. The Sino-American relationship has also deteriorated over a recently inked security pact between the U.S., Australia, and the U.K., known as AUKUS. Beijing says the trilateral partnership, which allows Australia to build nuclear-powered submarines, poses both a regional and global threat. Russian President Vladimir Putin has also accused the AUKUS alliance of fueling regional tensions. Putin's comments come as tensions are also running high between Russia and the West over a series of issues, including Ukraine. The pressure tactic by the U.S. and its allies have driven Moscow and Beijing closer than ever. Earlier this month, they signed a roadmap for closer military ties, citing growing conflict potential and frequent U.S. strategic bomber flights near their borders. Russia and China have realized that the American hegemonic goal, if unchecked, would pose a threat not only to their geostrategic interests, but other countries in the region and beyond.
Three students have been killed in a shooting incident at a high school in the U.S. city of Detroit, Michigan. Eight people, including a teacher, have also been wounded in the attack. Police say they have detained a 15-year-old suspect, a sophomore, at the school in connection with the incident. A teenager who is believed to have acted alone was arrested without resistance after firing 15 to 20 shots. The U.S. has a long history of deadly gun violence, with schools, workplaces, and shopping centers being frequently targeted. Last year, nearly 20,000 gun-related deaths were recorded in the country. Some 100,000 people are shot each year in the U.S. Some unwelcome news for Americans already grappling with price hikes. The U.S. Federal Reserve's chair is now warning that the threat of persistently high inflation has increased. In a testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, Jerome Powell said it is time to retire the term transitory for describing the burst of inflation. The annual inflation rate in the U.S. hit 6.2% in October, the highest in 31 years. Situation has been blamed on supply chain bottlenecks and shortages of goods and workers. Consumer confidence also fell in November to the lowest level in 9 months because of worries about high inflation and a potential resurgence of COVID-19. As costs of everyday items like food, gas, and rent quickly rise ahead of the holiday season, many in the U.S. are without jobs. Businesses there currently have nearly 5 million fewer people on their collective payrolls than they had before the pandemic. Leftist candidate Xiomara Castro is poised to become the first female president in the history of Honduras. With over half of the ballots counted, Castro has a safe lead of almost 20 percentage points over the ruling party candidate Nasri Asfora. She's already claimed victory, and the National Party of Honduras is also conceding defeat. Victory marks a return for the left to power. After 12 years, Castro is the wife of former President Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted in a coup in 2009. The new Honduran president faces multiple challenges, including high unemployment and crime rates, as well as rampant corruption. Caribbean island nation of Barbados has become the world's newest republic. 55 years after it gained independence from colonial master, the United Kingdom. An emotional historic day that has spurred debate on whether or not other Caribbean nations will follow suit and renounce the crown. From London, here's my good friend Said Purazo.
No kings or queens, but a president from the ranks of Barbadians charting a path forward for the world's youngest republic.
Today, debate and discourse have become action. Today, we set our compass to a new direction, girded by the successes of the last 55 years, buoyed by the confidence garnered from our triumphs and accomplishments.
One of those accomplishments, independence from monarchical rule in 1966, more than three centuries after British settlers arrived and turned the island into a wealthy sugar colony based on the work of hundreds of thousands of African slaves. The UK's Prince Charles, who stood somberly as the new Barbados was declared, had this to say.
From the darkest days of our past and the appalling atrocity of slavery, which forever stains our history, the people of this island forged their path with extraordinary fortitude.
Some experts are saying that Barbados becoming a republic is the natural progression of a trend that started in 1952 when Queen Elizabeth II acceded to the throne, that it will accelerate, not necessarily in this reign, but perhaps in the next.
The brutal history in Barbados and other Caribbean islands has also spurred calls for reparations from the UK. For now, though, this republic of nearly 300,000 will be celebrating throwing off the shackles of British colonialism and focus on building their future Barbadian style. Said Purazo, London.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump and the Republican Party have laid the groundwork for assuming the U.S. presidency regardless of the result of the 2024 election. And if they choose to pursue this plan, most of the conditions they would need to execute it are already in place. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Bruno Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump has already laid the groundwork to subvert the 2024 election. Stay tuned for more. Donald Trump and the Republican Party have laid the groundwork for assuming the U.S. presidency regardless of the result of the 2024 election, and if they choose to pursue this plan, most of the conditions they would need to execute it are already in place. If this sounds outrageous, please read on, keeping in mind that the presidential election is determined by the slates of electors that the states send Congress for certification. Given this oddity in electoral process in the United States of America, here are some things that a politician would need in order to have a chance of subverting the U.S. presidential election. Control over half of a state legislature, something that can be achieved through severely partisan gerrymandering and self-serving redistricting. At least some swing state legislatures radical enough to either suppress voters sufficiently to achieve their preferred result, replace the Board of Election if it doesn't arrange for the preferred candidate to win, and send a non-elected slate of electors for certification regardless of the election's actual result. Control of the House of Representatives and preferably both houses of Congress. The ability to purge moderates who might not go along with the ending of democracy. Total loyalty from one's political party and a cult-like allegiance from voters. A complacent or cooperative Supreme Court. Widespread skepticism among voters about the idea that elections are run fairly. A skepticism that can be fed by the constant challenging of legitimate results by the loser of an election. And here are some additional factors that could further assist a politician bent on stealing an election in the United States of America. Sufficient voter suppression to make the plan unnecessary, or at least enough to make results close enough to sow even more doubt about the legitimacy of results. Cynicism and confusion so deep that huge numbers of people don't believe in facts of any kind. Roving white nationalist militias that tout voter suppression and spread skepticism about the legitimacy of elections, and a sizable minority of the population that believes deep down that black people and immigrants are not real Americans and that their votes should not determine the results of elections. Now, let's look back at these conditions for how a politician might subvert an election. For Trump and the GOP, most of these boxes are already checked, and most of others are well underway. The endless repetition of the big lie, the sham audits in Arizona, the new voter suppression laws in 19 states, the demonization of mass media through the fake news mantra, the packing of Supreme Court with federally society-approved right-wing justices, the purging of Representative Liz Cheney, the encouragement of the Proud Boys, these are sometimes covered as random and disparate strands rather than part of a plan that makes total sense once you know what the goal is. Assuming Trump runs for president, he will likely make countless accusations of fraud echoed by his supporters. Between Election Day and December 16, 2024, the date electors in each state meet to formally vote for president and vice president. On that day, legislatures in at least some swing states that Democrats have won could use laws passed in the wake of the 2020 elections to invalidate the results and select a slate of electors for Trump. For example, Senate Bill 202, the Georgia law famous for prohibiting distribution of water to voters waiting in lines, less famously but more insidiously allows state officials to take over local election boards. In other words, the radical right legislature that passed the law in the first place can easily and legally manipulate the result. On January 6, 2025, when Congress opens the envelopes, there would either be enough electoral votes for Trump or enough states with competing slates of electors or other forms of chaos to declare that neither candidate has reached the requisite 270 electoral votes. At that point, the election would be determined by one vote per state. With Republicans having a majority of congressional representatives in a majority of states, and with moderates purged from the party, it's hard to imagine the states doing anything but selecting Trump. This scenario is plausible even if voter suppression is insufficient to award the popular vote in swing states to Trump. It doesn't matter how much he loses by, if the state legislatures have the power to determine the electoral slate sent to Congress. What can be done to guard against the possibility that the 2024 election could unfold in this way? Electoral resistance. The Democrats could mobilize to hold on to a majority of the House of Representatives. Legislative resistance. The Senate could pass federal voting legislation that would override the worst provisions in the wave of state laws recently passed. In particular, the federal law would have to reverse the takeover provisions that allow the state legislatures to replace or overrule local election boards. This could happen either by suspending the filibuster rule and getting all 50 Democratic Senate votes, or by getting 10 or more Republican senators to support it. Judicial resistance. President Joe Biden could appoint 4 or more new Supreme Court justices to block this from happening during the inevitable litigation, and the Senate could confirm them. State-level resistance. Courageous secretaries of state in swing states could invoke Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which prohibits anyone who has taken an oath to defend the Constitution from holding elect office if they have participated in insurrection or rebellion against the U.S. These election officials could and arguably would be obliged to refuse to place Trump on the ballot. The mentioned steps might seem extreme and even provocative, but without at least one of them, the United States is at serious risk of a democracy-shaking attack on its elections. And at the moment, all of them seem distant and unlikely. This is a 5-alarm fire, yet right now, no elected Democrat is consistently sounding the alarm. Not Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, not House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, not Senator Bernie Sanders, not Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and definitely not Senator Joe Manchin. This is DEFCON for democracy, yet the president barely mentions it. To be sure that democracy will survive in the United States, Democrats must take seriously the possibility of this nightmare scenario and take bold action to prevent it from happening.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadiri, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio is our new friend, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Sheikh, our question today is a theological question, but also perhaps a question of principle. And the question is as follows. Why are dogs in Islam, with all of the benefits that this animal has, considered ritually impure? Like, where is it mentioned in the Holy Quran? And the question even goes on, the question asked even says, like, the clothes of a prayer sayer, if it is stained with, for example, cow dung, and he prays, his prayer is valid. It is accepted by Allah. But even if there's one strand of dog hair on the prayer sayer's clothing, his prayer is invalid. Why this distinction?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. This is a very beautiful question and very valid question, actually. Let me start in this way. There is, you know, if you look at the Islamic sources, we have different Islamic sources. First of all, as you mentioned, is Noble Quran, and then right. We have the narrations of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam, including Holy Prophet Muhammad. And then we have rational reasons, which right. We call it aql, and consensus, ijma, and so on and so forth.
So rational arguments are also part.
Yeah, it's right. Part of that, the Islamic sources. So it is not necessary that all Islamic laws has been mentioned into the verses of Noble Quran. I can give you lots of examples that the verses of the Noble Quran does not mention particular Islamic laws.
Some very fundamental laws, like how to pray.
Yes, of course. We have many verses talking about the different Islamic laws.
Right.
But it is not necessary that all Islamic laws and rituals has been mentioned into the verses of the Noble Quran, because beside that, we have narrations and other Islamic sources, right. As I mentioned. Another point is that, first of all, I think it is very actually necessary to mention one Islamic point about the rights of the animals and rights of the nature.
Right.
You see that in Islam, we have a lot of emphasis on the rights of the animals. If you look at different narrations, you can find them very amazing. For example, one narration I would like to share with you is about feeding dogs or any other animals.
About feeding dogs.
Yes.
That's what the narration is about.
Yeah, or quenching the thirst of a dog.
Right.
It is very rewarding, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to reward such a person who feed a dog, or, for example, quenching the thirst of the dog.
Right.
Or any other animal. And it has been mentioned in narrations that it is forgiveness of the sin of that person.
So
that
by doing this good deed of even feeding a dog or providing water for a dog, your sins get pardoned by Allah.
Exactly. And it has been mentioned that it is kind of sadaqah,
right.
Or
it's a charity.
It's right. A charity. And a lot of reward has been mentioned, and it is a great emphasis on feeding a dog or any other animals.
For that matter, yes, any other living being.
Yes. And for example, I would like to share one narration from Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salatu wassalam. He said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala likes quenching the thirst of any person, okay, including animals.
Any living being then, not just persons.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala likes it. And then he said that if you quench the thirst of animal or any other being, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he will protect you in his protection.
Right.
And that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give you a great reward for quenching a thirst of any being, as you mentioned, including different animals and dogs and so on and so forth. So you see that how rewardful is this kind of action that you right. your treatment with any other animals. Let me go further to the nature.
Right.
How Islam, this beautiful religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this divine religion, talks about the rights of nature.
Even nature has rights.
Let me share one narration. In that narration, Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salatu wa salam, he said that if only one day remaining to the day of judgment and you have one plant, you should plant it, okay? You should do it very soon, and you should not delay to any other day. And a lot of reward has been mentioned for planting, yes?
Right.
And for keeping safe and for safeguarding
for watering plants and stuff like that.
Watering
as well.
Plants, yes, and safeguarding the plants.
For plants.
Yes,
right.
Plants.
For somebody who, because we have all these now new political movements and Protect Nature and Greenpeace and so on. Islam had this 1,400 years ago.
Yes, exactly. And, if you go to these different kind of narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, with regard to the rights of the natures and rights of the animals, you find
right.
them very interesting. And how, as you said, Islam, many centuries ago, has been mentioned these kind of, taking
right.
care
it
and the rights of
it is a perfect religion, of
yes,
course.
Rights of the animals and rights of the natures. So, about the dogs, we are talking
right.
about different dogs. Islam takes care of the rights of the dog. You
right.
should take care of it, you should feed it, and you should quenching the thirst of dog, taking
right.
care
if
of all
of
that.
If you own a dog, of course.
Yes, of course,
right.
you can own it.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Point it has been mentioned that you should take care you should have distance from some dogs because of the ritual impurity within it.
Right.
Let me expand on this point. In Islam, you should look at the benefit. You should look at some rational benefit for the dogs. What is the
right.
rational benefit? In Islam, we have, for example, you have three kind of dogs, as an example, of course.
Right.
Sheep dogs,
Right, used to flocks and shepherds, they
yeah,
use them
yeah,
a lot.
Exactly. Right. And then you have guard dogs.
Right.
And then you have hound,
A hound, right.
Yes. These three kinds of dogs, they have some kind of rational benefit.
They have
them.
A use.
They have a use,
right. They
yes.
They have a professional
right.
use.
Yes.
Right.
And of course, we have no problem about them. You can have them in your house,
right.
And of course, with some distance, you can benefit from these kind
right.
of dogs.
Right.
Let me mention this point: all kind of dogs, they have some kind of ritual impurity within it. And
right.
it does not mean that Islam does not care about the rights of the animals.
Or because it is just because they look dirty or some other reason like that, as some people say.
Yeah, yeah.
And also in regards to pigs, they say you do not eat pigs because you think they roll in mud around all day.
Yes.
That's not the only reason, and perhaps that's not even the reason at all.
Yes, you're
right.
Right. Islam does not want to humiliate any kind of dogs or, for example, disregard the
right.
rights of dogs and so on and so forth. Only Islam wanted to say that you should have kind of distance from dogs because of this ritual impurity within it.
Right.
And maybe this kind of looking at dogs is kind of, you can say, some kind of respect or some kind of safeguarding to the dogs. Because if they have distance,
some little holes for the dog, a specific
right.
place for the dogs.
Right.
They can rest. You can look at them.
You have their own living space and environment.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
You can look at them. You can have more, you know, care for dogs.
Right.
And of course, it's kind of.
So
I
there also is a benefit in that.
Yeah, it's kind of benefit
it, right.
actually for the dogs
right.
to have some kind of distance from that.
But the primary thing about this is because there are some spiritual that we cannot see. There are some hidden aspects of this dog that negatively affects us.
Yes, yes.
And that's the primary reason we go for.
Yeah. Of course, with regard to the Islamic laws, maybe we cannot find the final philosophy of that.
Right.
Of course, we can do some attempts and try to find some kind of wisdom, which we call
right.
it in Islamic jurisprudence, some kind of hikmah or wisdom.
Right. We try to rationalize it out with arguments.
Yeah, yeah.
But problem with these arguments sometimes are you cannot have a perfect argument.
Yes, you're right. You're right. But we cannot say what is the final purpose
right.
and philosophy
right.
behind this kind of Islamic laws.
Right.
But as I said, I don't want to repeat myself. We can find some kind of wisdom besides
right.
some Islamic laws, and the wisdom that I mentioned here is because is some kind of ritual impurity within dogs
right.
and pigs, of course.
Right, yeah.
Beside that, and then you should have some taking care about that.
Right.
In Islam, you know. It is actually, let me share one narration. He said that, يَكْرَهُ أَن يَكُونَ فِي دَارِ الرَّجُلِ الْمُسْلِمِ الْكَلْبِ In this narration, Imam said that it is disliked to have a dog in your house.
Where
you
do
know?
You live?
It means it is not forbidden. It is not forbidden, but
right.
it is kind of dislike for you.
It's
for
distasteful.
Any
it's better you do not have it in your house.
Yeah, it is better not to have it. You know, inside your house.
Right.
If you want to have it, you can have it in your yard, okay?
Right.
Outside
yeah.
your house,
right.
and you
right.
know, it's just some specific place for the particular
right.
place for
just
that
put
dog.
A barrier between you two.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But it is not. It is much better not to intermingle with the dogs, not to
right.
having in your home and this kind
you
of.
May get a family member.
Yeah,
some
make
societies
family members
do.
And so on and so forth. This is actually this in Islam is this dislike to have.
Right.
This kind of interaction with dogs.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, we have many other related Islamic laws to that. For example, in one narration, we have that, Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, he said that, Ritsun najis la yutawadda bifadli. It means that remaining water of the dogs, if one dog
was drinking from a container, for
yeah,
example.
In one container, it is much better not to take wudu or ablution with the remaining water of dogs.
Right. So again, there is a hint that it is spiritual related and
yeah.
not how they look or how the rational benefits. No, it is something spiritual related that we do not understand.
Yes, yes, yes.
And with that note, dear Sheikh, I will unfortunately have to interrupt you because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sheikh for his insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي Saying
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin has said British ministers, including his counterpart Priti Patel, should stop saying one thing in private while insulting his country in public if there is to be a solution to the crisis in the Channel. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled, UK's double talk on Channel crisis must stop, says French Interior Minister. French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin has said British ministers, including his counterpart Priti Patel, should stop saying one thing in private while insulting his country in public if there is to be a solution to the crisis in the Channel. In an interview with The Guardian, Gérald Darmanin strongly criticised what he called double talk coming out of London and said France was not a vassal of the UK. Relations are good when we speak in private. Every week I have my British counterpart on the telephone, and when we have personal meetings and exchange messages, we see the United Kingdom has a serious approach and we have things in common, Darmanin said. Then, as soon as it's something said in public, in the House of Commons or on social media and the press, there's a difference of tone that becomes strongly unfriendly, and is often different, even diametrically the opposite of what has been said in private. The more France is used as a punching bag for British domestic politics, and we hear provocative statements like France has to take back all the immigrants, the harder it becomes to find a solution. It's not only insulting, it's totally unrealistic. Gérald Darmanin was speaking after France convened a meeting of ministers responsible for immigration from Germany, Holland, Belgium, as well as the European Commissioner for Internal Affairs. Representatives from the European Union's Agency for Law Enforcement Cooperation, Europol, and Frontex, the EU's border management agency, were also invited to the hastily arranged summit in Calais, France, on Sunday, 28th of November. The meeting was called after 27 people died in the channel on Wednesday, 24th of November, a tragedy that shocked both sides of the channel and has sparked a blame game between London and Paris. Priti Patel's invitation to the meeting was rescinded on Friday, 26th of November, after Boris Johnson published a letter to Emmanuel Macron calling on France to do more to stop channel crossings, including allowing British naval forces to patrol French coastal areas, which France has refused, citing concerns about sovereignty, and to accept refugees being returned. Gérald Darmanin said he had a cordial relationship based on trust with Priti Patel, but expressed growing French frustration at the mixed and contradictory messages heard from Boris Johnson's government. This frustration was voiced by Emmanuel Macron on Friday, when he accused the United Kingdom of a lack of seriousness over the Channel crisis. The French president was furious that Boris Johnson had published a letter to him on Twitter, calling on France to take back immigrants and questioning the country's refusal to allow British naval forces to join patrols on France's northern coast. French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin reiterated that frustration. When it comes to the British government in general, it's very difficult to work in a calm manner. Relations are fine with ministers, but unfortunately, as soon as there's a camera or they're in Parliament, we seem to hear them say something very different, he said. I say again, France is not a subsidiary of the United Kingdom. We are a free and equal country with Great Britain, and we want to be treated as such. Treated as allies, not vassals, and not be hostage to British domestic politics. He was incredulous at Priti Patel's suggestions that Britain could send naval ships or naval forces to turn back refugee boats mid-channel. We do not imagine for a single instant that Britain could just ignore all the international conventions and maritime laws to put warships in the 30-kilometre between Britain and France to turn back boats when it will mean dozens of people, pregnant women, children, the elderly, who will die. We cannot imagine for one second that this could enter a British head, he said. The question of people crossing from France to the United Kingdom has poisoned relations between London and Paris for decades. Tightened security around ferry ports and the Channel Tunnel have driven refugees camped out along France's northern coastline to increasingly desperate measures. French police tear up makeshift refugee camps, destroying tents and busing people elsewhere in France, where they are encouraged to apply for asylum in France. But within weeks, the majority return to the Calais area of northern France. Gérald Darmanin repeated that France would not accept British forces in France. What would the British say if we suggested having French troops on the English coast? They would say, quite understandably, that they are a free country and they want their sovereignty respected, and we say the same thing. There's nothing extraordinary in that, he said. It's better that the British ask themselves why so many migrants want to go to the United Kingdom. This is first because the labour market of your country works in part with clandestine immigrants, because in your country you can work and even pay taxes without having any identity papers or be in any kind of regular situation. If there was a change in the labour law in Britain tomorrow, there would be a lot fewer migrants who would want to cross over. Secondly, unfortunately, the British government today no longer allows any legal way for people to access their territory as immigrants. The British government disputes Gérald Darmanin's characterisation of the UK labour market, saying people have to prove their immigration status to work or to rent a property in Britain. A White House source said, "We will this week have more talks with counterparts on how we can work together to resolve this Europe-wide crisis. Priti Patel's Nationality and Borders Bill is the first step in addressing the broken asylum system and the pull factors it creates. Gerald Darmanin confirmed the UK had paid France 17 million euros of the 67 million euros agreed in July to police its northern coast, but added, "Sometimes I read in the British press that you pay us to intervene, but this costs us 250 million euros a year. Of course, 67 million euros helps, but it costs us a lot more." The minister said he will be reporting to Emmanuel Macron on Monday and had a series of meetings scheduled for next week on the crisis and specifically on how to clamp down on smuggling networks. On the question of returning refugees in return for Britain accepting unaccompanied children or minors, a proposal Priti Patel outlined in Parliament last week, Gerald Darmanin said this would have to be agreed at the European level. "If we could send children or minors to the United Kingdom, you think we would refuse? No, we would accompany them all the way. We are ready to consider minors going to the UK in return for migrants being returned to Belgium, France or Germany or the Netherlands, as long as it is one for one." The British say they want to return a number of migrants for one, he said. Darmanin said screaming headlines in the British press attacking French police and gendarmes were insulting. "It's an insult to France and the French police who risk their lives every day. It's terrible to hear things like that from the English side, because not only are we guarding the border for the English, we are suffering the political consequences of this decision. That's enough. It has become extremely insulting. We have to stop the slogans and work seriously." Asked if he was planning to speak to his counterpart Priti Patel in the next few days, Darmanin replied, "There's no meeting foreseen, but she has my mobile number and I have hers. I tell you again, I respect her and know her well. All I ask is for the same respect from the United Kingdom so we can talk on the basis of equality and France is not considered subservient to the UK. From the moment we're treated normally, we can discuss things seriously and everyone will make an effort to try to understand and try to advance the discussion. At the moment, we have the impression that only France is making an effort."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.